thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a bi-weekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number one for March 7th, 2007. Wikipedia, friend or foe? I'm Dan Cohen, this week's host. Well, welcome to our first episode of Digital Campus. Today, around the virtual roundtable, we have Mills Kelly from edwired.org. Hi, Mills.
Hey, how are you, Dan?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
I'm doing just great.
Great. And we also have Tom Scheinfeld from foundhistory.org.
Hey, Dan.
Well, we're very excited. We've been thinking about starting this podcast for some time now. And as we say in the intro, this is a place for us to have an informal discussion about some of the issues relating to digital technology and the internet and how it's affecting our lives, our teaching, students, learners, researchers, people in academia, libraries, museums. And we hope you find it interesting as well. And we're also going to provide ways at the end of the podcast, we'll mention how you can get involved too. And in each podcast, we're going to start off with a news roundup segment, things that we've spotted in the news that are of interest to the digital campus. And so we'll start there today. Tom, what do you have from this week?
What do I have? Well, I mean, I think the big news in the wider world of computing is obviously Vista. You know, we're all Mac users here, so we should probably try to give equal time to our friends on PCs out there. I think Vista is going to be a big development. People are going to have to start switching over. And I think the big question is, how quickly will campuses, museums, libraries, other places for digital learning and scholarship, how quickly they're going to switch over to the new system, and whether this is really even a big story at all?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a while before an awful lot of university campuses switch over, just because of the cost factor. I think most campuses that I'm familiar with are pretty satisfied with the level of technology they have and don't have a ton of money to pour into an operating system upgrade. Now, it may be that they've been saving against the day that they're going to have to do this, but I think we're going to see a slower implementation on campus anyway.
I mean, do we have any kind of a site license at George Mason? Do you guys know for Vista yet, or is that coming? Or
I believe so. I think we will get a site license for that. I don't know if we actually have the burned CDs of it, or DVDs actually, because it's so large. But I'm sort of wondering what's the impact? I mean, what are the features that really help us help students, help professors, help other people in cultural heritage work? What is it? What's the value? I mean, it's got better search.
It does look nice. I mean, that's one of the big questions. I mean, the big criticism on the wider reporting on this has been, it more or less does what Mac OS X does, and it has widgets, it has better searching, and I've used it a little bit in Parallels on the Mac, and I mean the search feature is really pretty good. I mean, it's definitely better than the Spotlight feature on the Mac.
So I guess you can find documents or search your Word documents faster. I suppose those things are important.
I think the bigger hindrance to adoption is probably going to be that you need a pretty nice new machine to actually get
right.
all of
Good
the
point.
The graphical features out of it. And you know, campuses, while they may get the Vista site license, they aren't going to be upgrading, for instance, all the machines in the library very soon. So it's questionable how important this is really going to be.
Right. You know, it kind of makes me wonder. At the same time, Google released their Google Apps for businesses, but they've also been plugging their Google apps like Google Docs and spreadsheets for campuses as well. And it kind of makes you wonder if the operating system is quickly approaching the time when it's sort of irrelevant. If you've got your web browser and you've got, you know, fairly decent apps in your web browser, what does it matter?
Well, this is the question that I really have, is whether it's this iteration of operating system upgrade or the next iteration that's going to force an awful lot of campuses into the open source environment or to the web app environment, just because of the reason that Tom mentioned. I mean, sure, George Mason can get a site license for Vista, but most of the computers that are floating around campus, whether they're student information terminals or library terminals or whatever they might be, all of those are going to have to be upgraded to take advantage of these new
right.
features. And that's where the money isn't, is in the hardware upgrade.
Right. I mean, it would be just an immense amount of money to replace all those computers with 3 megahertz Pentium 4s with the correct video cards to handle Aero Glass. It just doesn't seem like it's going to happen that quickly to me. And,
yeah,
you know, almost sort of why bother at some point with the expense?
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I know we've been using some of the Google apps, the spreadsheet and the docs for writing some grant proposals, and it works pretty good. I mean, it you know, it's not quite as fully featured as Office, and I think actually something probably we want to save for another day is Microsoft Office 2007 or whatever
right.
it is, which is probably a bigger deal in the end than Vista is. But the Google apps, they work pretty well. There are definitely some drawbacks. You know, having to do with, you know, it's a web application, so there's some feedback performance issues and some features that aren't there that you'd wish that they were.
Yeah, footnoting would be nice. You know, for us academics,
right.
support for footnotes would be a little helpful. But
right, and there is like this weird hack in the Google Docs that allows you to add a footnote, but it really doesn't work very well.
No. But you know, I definitely could see the day where they could add something like that in, and I would love it if my students submitted their papers just virtually through Google Docs. I could look back at, you know, revisions that they've made. I could comment on a rough draft just online. Seems to me like there's a lot of advantages here.
Yeah, that would be really pretty great.
And for me, I contemplated that this semester actually, and it was the lack of a footnote feature was the thing that kept me from doing it.
Yeah, I think there's another problem in moving students to these kinds of things if it's not supported by the university, and it's that you end up having to train them in doing it. I mean, you know, it seems fairly obvious to some of the us, you know, technorati people how to set up a Gmail account and get onto Google Docs and start writing and sharing and all of that. But I think, you know, we tend to think that our students are, because they're 18 or 19 years old, that they're automatically tech literate. And I don't necessarily think that's the case. I think, you know, they still require a lot of handholding to use new applications. So if it's not supported by the university or the institution, getting people to use it is difficult.
I think it also has a lot to do with the mix of students that we have. I mean, for instance, I have a number of students who don't have Microsoft Office installed on their computers because it was too expensive for them to purchase when they bought their computer at home.
That's a great point. I do think, you know, cost is a big part of this. I mean, Office is, what, $400?
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of software that people use on campus that is the second you graduate, you no longer have the site license for, and it's pretty expensive. I mean, EndNote is a couple hundred dollars, $300 maybe. Microsoft Office is incredibly expensive. And so you could kind of see a, you know, good enough application like Google Docs making pretty good headway against these big expensive packages.
And if you add to that it can be, you know, run in Firefox on Ubuntu or some other open source or Linux based operating system, I mean, you end up with almost no cost.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah, it is a great point, but then you have to have the tech skills to deal with that on your own as opposed to relying on the university service.
Right. You know, I think one thing that Google could do, you know, of course, we love using podcasts to give advice to large corporations, but boy, couldn't they just have some kind of better help documentation for Google Docs? They just assume that you can figure everything out, but You know, I found, and we're doing this on the Zotero project, just a nice introductory screencast goes a long way. And I think doing something like that. They are giving seminars. It's really interesting to hear on our local Washington, D.C. radio station.
I noticed that. Yeah.
They're giving seminars now for government workers for Google Apps. So maybe we can sneak into one of those. Have our students sneak into one of those.
Yeah, I'm sure they'd love that.
Just to round the bases on various applications that we use here on campus, Blackboard has come out with this statement about their patents, and I'm not sure if our listeners have been following this, but Blackboard got a, which is a sort of course management system that a lot of campuses use, and they just merged with WebCT, which was the other big on-campus course management system. So they think they have about 85% of the market, but that went through. And they came up with a patent which seemed extremely broad for, you know, essentially covering online learning and exchange of information. And it just seemed preposterous, and it also seemed to threaten big open source projects like Sakai, which is a competing open source software for course management. Did Tom and Mills, did you see the outcome of that where they said, well, we give blanket protection to open source projects like Sakai for these patents?
Yeah, I read about this, and the thing that bothered me when I read it is that they have given a sort of a blanket pass to all the projects that they've named. What about the projects that they didn't name? What about the projects that people haven't come up with yet? It seems to me that they're reserving to themselves the right to sue people who may have a new idea next year.
Right. I think the problem, I mean, it's very nice of them to, you know, allow Sakai, which has existed for several years now, to continue to exist. but in the end, they're still asserting this patent on information sharing in a university context, which just, I mean, it speaks to the larger problem of the patent office
yeah,
these days,
the
where you
patents.
Can get a patent for almost anything. I mean, you just come up with any kind of business process, some idea, and you can patent it. And it's just a recipe for litigation. And it seems to me, you know, it's sinister in the commercial world of music and TV and all that, but it seems especially sinister to me, at least, in the educational world. It's just not at all in the spirit of what we do.
I agree there. I mean, hopefully in the long run, I guess the patent will be invalidated and all of this won't matter. But that seems unlikely to happen at this point.
Yeah.
Well, while we're criticizing Blackboard, they did finally release their scholar.com, I don't know what you would call it, their experiment in Web 2.0, which I've already blasted on my blog as one of the ugliest websites I've seen this year. But I guess it does get add a tagging feature and various social applications to their wide installed base of course management software where people can tag things on syllabi and share them with each other. It doesn't seem to me like it's going to go very far.
Well, I don't think it's going to go very far at all, because there's, in addition to the fact that it seems kind of clunky, the real problem, I think, is that I don't expect students to make much use of this because it's a closed environment. It's, you know, they can tag things within the Scholar system, within the Blackboard system, but it doesn't seem to provide enough connection to the wider world of social networking, and that's the real advantage of social networking.
And I haven't taken a really good look at it, but I'm a little unclear. Like, what does it do that something like, you know, a social bookmarking service like Delicious or Magnolia, what does it do that those things don't do?
I think their point is that this is highly vetted stuff. So, you know, this is only materials that are being saved by scholars, and so it's a higher quality of resources. They say find relevant, reliable resources, but you know, I think for there, you already have resources like, let's say, in the sciences, Connotia at connotia.org, where you can, you know, subscribe to groups and tags of people who are following new journal articles. You know, it just doesn't seem to me, and I think Mills has a good point there, you know, these systems work. I mean, Delicious took off because it was just so open, and they had an API which allowed people to export materials from it and into it, and This just seems like a walled garden that isn't going to grow very much.
It is an interesting kind of a larger question. I think we were talking around it with the Google Apps discussion. Is, you know, to what extent do we need specifically geared educational software when there are good options out there for in the wider world of the web that you can cobble together that really work, that where the students already are, they're already on places like Delicious and MySpace and YouTube, Flickr. You can cobble resources together from those commercial and publicly available resources. You can cobble together systems that really do work in education. And I'm thinking, Mills, of what one of your students, one of our grad students in the Center for History and New Media, did last semester with Flickr. Ken Albers, who happens also to be our audio engineer, maybe you could say a little bit about what Ken did with Flickr.
Yeah, I mean, Ken took this freely available capability in Flickr, and which allows you to mark up images that you've posted into the system, and in addition to adding tags, which would make it possible for people to search and find their way to what you were working on, you can also actually add markup to the image itself, so that as you mouse over the image, you see that a box appears, and then you can click on that, and text appears in that box. So he was highlighting specific elements of Courier and Ives prints, particularly racist Courier and Ives prints, and showing the you know, leaving some commentary about the specific sort of racist ideas that are presented there to the larger public that bought Courier and Ives material. But then in addition to that, they have a discussion feature which allows the user to then, or multiple users to interact around that image. And so if you're a teacher, you put an image up, you leave a couple of comments on the image, things that you want your students to pay attention to. They can leave their own comments on the image itself. And then in addition to that, you can post guiding questions below the image in a discussion format, and they can respond to that. And this can either be a public discussion or it can be a private discussion where you only allow your students to have access to that material. And that's free. And it works. It works incredibly well. It's really simple.
Okay. Well, looks like we've reached the end of the news roundup, and we're going to move on now to our featured story. Well, we ended the news roundup with Mills discussing a really interesting student project by Ken Albers using Flickr, a publicly available site for sharing photos that I think is receiving some interesting uses on campus. But of course, the mother of all sites for students right now is the famous or infamous Wikipedia, which has been very much in the news recently. We know that Ted Stevens has been trying to ban it from federally funded libraries.
Is he going to close those tubes? Is that the idea?
I think he's going to close the tube off that that connects Wikipedia with schools and libraries. Who knows where that's going? I think most relevant for us is this very interesting story coming out of Middlebury College, on which the history department has in fact said that they are banning students from citing it. And I think there's been a little bit of misinformation about what's going on at Middlebury. And from what I hear, there was a very interesting on-campus debate recently between two professors about the value of Wikipedia. But we thought it would make a great first topic here for our featured story on Digital Campus about the value of Wikipedia. Is it friend or foe? And I wanted to start off by talking to Mills, who's written quite a bit about this on his blog. Mills, you're actually taking the audacious step of using Wikipedia in your class. I mean, explicitly telling students they have to use Wikipedia. Can you defend yourself, please?
No, I'm a hopeless crank, and I should probably quit my job now while I have a chance. No, the reason that I did this in a Western Civ class at George Mason is that it became clear to me, as I think it's clear to almost anyone who teaches at the college level these days, that students rely incredibly heavily on Wikipedia as their primary source of information about almost any topic.
Yeah, boy, did they ever.
And setting aside the conversation that I have with them about whether encyclopedias are appropriate for university level work, which I have all semester long, and especially when I'm grading their papers, but it occurred to me that we weren't doing a good job as educators in training the students to use a resource that they are going to use whether we tell them that they can or they can't. You know, I think it's certainly within anybody's power to say you can't cite Wikipedia. It is impossible to tell a student you can't use Wikipedia or any other resource because they're going to use what they're going to use.
Right.
So if they're going to use it, then we need to teach them how to use it appropriately, because not all of the information in Wikipedia is bad, obviously. In fact, a lot of it is pretty good. But for encyclopedia kind of content. But the problem is the students don't really understand how that information is constructed. They don't understand how it changes. They simply dial it up, find some useful information, and include it in their paper. And this is clearly a problem. So I decided, I'd been doing this as an extra credit assignment for the last couple of semesters, and it worked really pretty well. And so I rolled it out as a requirement in my Western Civ course this semester that the students in the class have to actually have to write an entry for Wikipedia, or they have to substantially edit one that already exists but needs a lot more attention. And they had to turn those in to me at the end of the second week of the semester. And then during the course of the semester, they have to track what happens to their entry. They have to see, and already some of them are outraged by what's happened. I've gotten a couple of really testy emails from students about, somebody changed my entry, and it's completely wrong what they did. Can I change it back? And so I, of course, tell them, yes, of course you can change it back. And so at the end of the semester, they're going to have to write an essay for me in which they analyze what happened to their entry. Not what the content of the entry was, but what happened to their entry, and what does this mean for the construction of knowledge in this digital age that they live in. And already what's happened is students are sending me emails in which they're working on a paper right now for me, and they're sending me emails in which they say, here's a draft of my paper, can you look at it? And I'm seeing in the footnotes that they're citing the version history of the entry. This is something that's never happened with me before. They always just cited the Wikipedia and the title of the entry and maybe the date they accessed it, but not the version, the specific version that they were looking at when they copied that information out. So it's already transformed the way that they're using this resource. And my goal, of course, is that I want them to know something about how that resource is constructed, the same way that your professors and my professors took us to the library and taught us how to use the library.
And these are freshmen, Mills?
Well, it's a freshman level course. It's a mix of freshmen, sophomores, and juniors.
Okay.
You know, I don't think a lot of people realize that Wikipedia actually has these other pages sort of hidden behind the entries. And it does seem like that's a good place to start with a better understanding of Wikipedia and how it's constructed. You know, if you just think it's an encyclopedia, and I think students here are often wrong about that, that they sort of view it as some fixed entity. And I think, Mills, what you're trying to do is expose that process of how it's constructed, which I think is, you know, is something that we discuss in history in general. It's, you know, even any book is sort of constructed away from sources, but then it ends up in a form that's, I guess, more fixed. But, you know, there are these other tabs that are rarely used by, I guess, common users. You know, most professors and students don't look at, say, the history of the page or the discussion part of the page, where there are various Wikipedians challenging each other, saying, you know, well, maybe we should or should not include such and such a piece of information. It's really fascinating to kind of look behind the scenes at what's going on there. I think you can really learn a lot from that.
Yeah, and in many ways, I mean, I think that's what's exciting about Wikipedia in general, is not it's not the front page that is the Wikipedia article. It's more the community that's building those articles and that's engaged in some, you know, fairly serious scholarly discussion. And we're talking about scholars, but also members of the general public, all working together to come to some historical, cultural, whatever, some kind of truth collaboratively. And in many ways, it's not that history tab and those discussions there, it's not all that different than what goes on in a university department or at the American Historical Association or in any other you know, forum for knowledge production. And I think that's the big thing that in all of these debates gets lost.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if scholars actually get involved. You know, there's this new project Citizendium, which is an awful word, that's actually trying to enlist scholars' credentials, those with credentials. It's gotten a lot of flack from the Wikipedia community, but it's an offshoot by Larry Sanger, who is one of the original Wikipedia founders. And, you know, I suspect in the long run, I think, you know, professors, graduate students are going to have to probably roll up their sleeves and just get involved with the main Wikipedia for them to make this better in the long run. I think also a good, you know, Roy Rosenzweig, our colleague, wrote a great article for the Journal of American History called Can History Be Open Source, in which he looked at some of these articles on American history on Wikipedia, and he found out that factually they're actually pretty correct. The problem is a kind of larger one of narratively they're not that great. You know, they'll never be the equivalent of that great history book that has a terrific narrative on a topic. But factually, they get a lot of things right, and they're getting those things right because there's a lot of people participating in some of these articles, and they correct each other, they debate things, they look at sources, they actually look at paper sources. So there is a lot of discussion going on.
And it's that this is one of the lessons that I've been trying to teach my students, is that the more people that are involved in the conversation and the editing about a particular entry, the more likely it is that that entry is reliable. Doesn't mean that it is reliable, but it's more likely to be reliable. So the other thing I say to them is the entry that I show them as the kind of beginning example is the Wikipedia entry on the Donner Party. And this is, you know, about the group of immigrants moving from the Midwest to California that get snowbound and don't make it through the passes, and ultimately some cannibalism occurs. And this is a big story in the westward movement. My fifth grader is learning about it this week. This entry was originally put up in Wikipedia back almost 2 years ago, and it's had almost 500 edits by a whole group of people. And these, as I say to my students, this is a community of enthusiasts. It's not necessarily a community of scholars. There are some scholars involved, but it's a community of enthusiasts, people who actually care about what the world is going to know about the Donner Party, and they're constantly tweaking this entry to include new information that comes out from archaeologists and that sort of thing. And so what I tell them is that this entry, you know, it slowly but surely has all the rough edges polished off to result in something that the community of enthusiasts can agree on. And that doesn't mean that it's cutting-edge scholarship. It means it's the current consensus of the people who care about this particular historical event.
Right.
And that's different from the kind of scholarship that they're going to find in a book in the library.
Yeah, and in the end, I think it's pretty important for scholars even to understand the concerns of that enthusiast community. I mean, you know, too often I think scholars are writing for themselves and for their immediate circle of peers. And, you know, I don't think it's a bad thing to expose students who, you know, are most of them unlikely to become professional historians or professional scholars of any sort, to expose them to those enthusiast communities, because there's a much greater chance, in fact, that they're going to end up working in those kinds of communities if they do choose to stick with something like cultural heritage or museum work or library work. I mean, some of our best students are going to end up in those positions, and the people they're going to encounter are those enthusiasts. And so to understand their concerns is I think a really important thing, and I think it's probably important for us scholars to understand as well.
And right. I think also it's important to remember that our students belong to communities of enthusiasm in a whole variety of ways. They're fans of a particular music group. They're fans of a particular sports team. They have all sorts of things that they are enthusiastic about, and the digital world makes it possible for them to join all sorts of people around the world who are also fans of that same particular piece of music. And so they participate in that kind of community of enthusiasts, and so to see that there's an element of this in the production of knowledge, I think, is really surprising to them.
Yeah, I think making the process of coming to factual consensus a little bit more interesting, exciting for students, I think is fantastic, and you know, I would laud what you're doing, Mills. I think, like you said, there's just people are always interested in, you know, details about their favorite things, and Wikipedia is a perfect place for that to be executed. And when they see that, I think if they can come to understand that, they can really understand what those who do go on to, say, get a PhD and are really, you know, obsessed in their own way about a specific time and or place or movement or event. I think they can come to understand the scholarly process very well. And, you know, I think there's probably some things that Wikipedia could do better to reassure, I guess, the academic community. And I think they're actually trending toward that. For instance, we've been in communication with some Wikipedians who are very interested in citing paper sources like books from historians better on their pages. So having a bibliography on the page or something that, you know, further reading that isn't just other links to websites but actually includes books is a great place to start. I think also you've probably noticed some of the Wikipedia entries are listed as being sort of community favorites, that there's a consensus that, wow, this is a really good page that's achieved a very high level of factual correctness and narrative value. And there was actually a recent study that confirms exactly what you were saying, Mills, which is that those pages that have been selected as being the best on Wikipedia by the Wikipedian community actually do end up being the most factually correct. And that's because they just have a lot of eyes looking at them and a lot of people editing them.
You know, one of the other things I think it's worth mentioning here is, and I think the current debate over Wikipedia kind of obscures, is the proliferation of wikis outside of Wikipedia,
right.
In the classroom, in research, in other venues, specialized wikis for specialized topics and specialized communities. You know, I noticed the CIA is using wikis to produce and share information. Scientists are starting to use wikis to share lab notes and results. There's a whole range of applications for this wiki approach,
right.
outside of Wikipedia that I'm worried that the concern and the debate over Wikipedia, which you know is obscuring those other uses for this pretty remarkable technology.
Yeah, I would completely agree, and I would put in a pitch for why we have to teach our students to use these kinds of technologies, because they're going to use them when they graduate from college. They may not necessarily use a wiki, but they may use some sort of social networking software. There are many different kinds of things that they will ultimately end up using in the world that they're going into after college. And if we don't teach them how to use these technologies in a variety of contexts, then they'll be less employable, they'll be less successful. And so I think all of us have an obligation to think about the ways that we can prepare our students for the world that they're going to face, not the world that we grew up in.
So it seems to me, wrapping up, that Wikipedia friend or foe, we all three of us say friend, but perhaps maybe cautious friend. Maybe not best friend? Best friend, Mills?
No, not a best friend, just a friend.
An acquaintance.
Yeah, good friend.
Yeah.
Good friend.
Good friend. Could be better.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. We'll invite Wikipedia.
Sometimes unreliable, sometimes stands you up, but a good friend.
Okay, great.
Always entertaining.
Right.
The end of each episode of Digital Campus, we wanted to throw out some links, resources, digital technologies that we're using, looking at, that we found helpful, and that we hope you find helpful too. Tom, you seem to have a resource that, speaking of Wikipedia, might be useful in that vein.
Yeah, keeping on the Wikipedia wiki tip, I've got two sites that I want to point people to, and they do more or less the same thing, and they have, you know, slightly different interfaces and, you know, different color schemes and things that, you know, you can pick and choose which one you like, but they're both make your own wiki sites, and they allow anybody to sign up for an account and set up a customized wiki on any topic they want. It gives you a persistent URL that you can point students or colleagues to, and you can basically just set up your own wiki. The first one is wetpaint.com, wetpaint.com. That's probably my favorite, and the other one is pbwiki.com, like peanut butter. pbwiki.com. And as I said, you know, both of them allow you to just set up a wiki. You can set up as many wikis as you want. So you could have a wiki just for a particular class and have your students, for instance, go in and have them write their own entries on characters they encounter in the novel you're reading. Or you could use it with colleagues if you're working on a book together or something. You could post research notes and add and change each other's research notes. So it's a free resource. It's really useful, and both interfaces are really cool, and I you know, people should check it out.
Do the wikis have to be public, Tom, or can you make them private?
You can make them private. You can set up multiple user accounts. You can have users with different permissions so that, you know, if you want students to be able to add their own entries and edit their own entries but not edit other students' entries, you can do that. You can set yourself up as an administrator so you can edit everybody's entries. You can have certain entries be read-only. There's a lot of different settings on these things, and they're really pretty powerful. You know, definitely for the price, they're worth a look.
Sounds great. Mills, what do you have for us this week?
The site I want to call attention to is worldmapper.com. I'm sorry, worldmapper.org. And WorldMapper is a collection of world maps, and on these maps, the territories are all resized according to the relationship of the data that you load into them. So, for instance, the map that I'm looking at right now is military spending in 2002, and so the United States, China are very large on this map, where South America shrinks away to almost nothing. There's another map of landmine casualties, and so there you see that the portions of Africa are very large, portions of South Central Asia are very large, where the, you know, North America is almost non-existent on the map. So you can load in any data set that you want, and then the geography shrinks or expands according to the relationship of those pieces of data to one another. They have some really interesting ones for historians. For instance, the population of the world in 1500 and then the population of the world in 2000, and you can see how the population has changed. The downside is that they use current political boundaries for these maps, but that's just a problem of the way that they've done it. This is also an open source application, and so anyone who wants to pull it down and tinker with it is more than welcome to do that. And so it's a very interesting resource, and I think we're going to see a lot of data being loaded into it over the next couple of years.
Sounds great. Now, this is the URL is not worldmapper.com. It's actually the first. If you just Google world space mapper, it's the first hit, and it's hosted at the University of Sheffield. Is that right?
Right. Yes, actually worldmapper.org.
Ah, worldmapper.org. We'll get you there.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. Terrific. This looks terrific. And the one resource, another open resource that I'd like to point to is, for some reason, I think very buried, or more buried than it should be on the internet, and that is the over 187,000 books have been digitized by the Open Content Alliance, which is a sort of rival to Google Books. And you would think these would be easier to find, but alas, they are at archive.org/details/texts. And that's where you can find these books. You can search the text. You can download every single one of them as PDFs or in other formats. You can grab the text that's behind them. And I just wanted to highlight this because, you know, Google, the Google Library Project, which is digitizing, from what I hear, about a million books a year, is getting a lot of press for obvious reasons. But here's a perfectly open text archive. It just needs a better URL. I think eventually they're going to have a better interface at openlibrary.org or one of these other URLs they've gotten. And you can actually access all these texts through, of all places, Microsoft's book search site. But here's the real home over at the Internet Archive, and that's archive.org, just as it sounds. Well, I want to thank all of you for joining me. Thanks, Mills. Thanks, Tom. It's great to talk to you.
Thanks,
and
Dan. Yeah, thanks.
Sure. I want to emphasize that you can visit us online at our blogs. Tom can be found at foundhistory.org. Mills' blog is at edwired.org, and I am at the eponymous dancohen.org. Thanks again, and we'll be back live from the Center for History and New Media in 2 weeks with a new episode of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself.
please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music. Please join us again in 2 weeks for another episode of Digital Campus. Thank you.